Welcome to hour two of the Global Research News Hour. Am I on, Carrie? Okay. The wonders of live radio. Usually we have a musical introduction, not this hour, no problem. The program is about information, not music. We're the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. I have a glorious guest on for this hour. A man who has been a many-year iconic figure for me. Ed, I don't mean to embarrass you, but maybe I will a little bit. Edward Herman is my guest. He is, oh my goodness, Ed, how do I describe you? You're Professor Emeritus of Finance at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. You and I were there at the same time, but I never bumped into you there. Which was, I wish I could go back and begin over again so I could do it. But you taught there for many years. Ed is an economist, a political and media analyst, a very prolific writer, an author of many books. And I've got to mention your classic, Ed. If my count is right, you've co-authored four books with Noam Chomsky, but the classic that I think will live forever is the one on the media, Manufacturing Consent, the Political Economy of the Mass Media. And I will never forget Chapter 2, Ed. Do you remember that episode that I had on that?
what was it, Steve?
Chapter 2 of Manufacturing Consent.
I don't remember the episode.
I wrote an article called Worthy and Unworthy Victims and didn't realize that was the title of your Chapter 2. And you pointed it out to me, and I think I said something at the time. I will never for the rest of my life ever forget Chapter 2 of Manufacturing Consent.
It's a very good chapter.
The entire book is a very good. You wrote that chapter yourself.
I was the principal author, certainly, yes.
But the book is really, if there's one book to read on understanding the media and how it works against us, and for those in power, it's to read Manufacturing Consent. It was published 20 years ago, Ed, but it's as relevant today as it was the day that it came out, and it's very easy to get. And for listeners who haven't read that book, I think it's more important than ever to read it and understand it now, because it'll explain how the most important things we need to know about aren't being told us at maybe the most perilous time in our history. But, Ed, so much going on, and we want to cram as much into the hour as possible. Welcome to the program, number one.
Thanks, Steve. Steve, there's a 2002 edition, updated edition of Manufacturing Consent.
Oh, I didn't know that. I have a much older edition. People can get that. When we hear music come on, it means we're going to take a brief commercial break. Let's do that, Ed, and then jump right into the discussion. Steve Lenman. I'm on with Edward Herman. Ed, maybe we can begin a little bit with the financial crisis and then branch off into other important topics. One quick comment from me. It's very disturbing to me, and I'm sure you too, that as important as this topic is, there's no question how important it is, but it literally is erasing everything else on air. You don't hear about the two illegal wars going on. You don't hear about occupied Palestine. You don't hear about the new confrontation with Russia. You don't hear about such important things that, heaven forbid, could get us into another war. You don't hear about these things, and it's important that we do hear about it. Well, you hear about it on this program, Ed. I don't ignore those topics. I get into them with guests. The financial thing is one, but everything else is important, too. But I'm interested in your comments about the financial crisis and the causes and so on and so forth and where we go from here. There's no question how gravely serious this is.
Yeah, it's certainly big time, but it's a little uncertain as to what's going to happen, Steve. It's, I actually think that the dominant parties here, people like Paulson and the rest of them, I think they were a little surprised. I don't I think they anticipated. In fact, in the Times, I guess today or yesterday, Gretchen Morgenson has some really beautiful quotes from Paulson from, you know, just many, many months back, her serial quotes on how the situation is finally stabilized. And I really do think that the boys at the top, they're taking advantage of the situation, but I don't think they realized its gravity. They didn't realize how difficult it was, and they thought they could pull out easily. Of course, they're taking advantage of it. They're trying their best to take advantage of it, and one can argue that the way they've handled this crisis is really just a sort of a continuation of the Bush class war. That is, the victims are not to get given a lot of aid, or in fact any aid.
Oh, absolutely.
And they've rushed to help the guys who did it. And in fact, Paulson himself is a member of Goldman Sachs. You could say here is pure conflict of interest. This guy brought in his Treasury Secretary, now supposedly managing the crisis, when he was a very important part of the machinery that brought about the crisis. But ideologically, he was a free marketer and didn't like regulation, and he and his buddies helped the deregulation process that led to this disaster. And even all through the process so far, Paulson and his buddies have been resisting doing anything that would threaten the big boys and their independence. And they wouldn't want to bring the government in, of course, but as a bailout for the big boys, and interfering as little as possible with the ongoing financial machinery. That financial machinery has broken, has cracked, has failed the public, but they don't want it tampered with. So even a Gordon Brown in England rushes, he comes in to a similar crisis in Great Britain, and he wants to, his first program is to pump capital into the banks, but to take stock in the banks, and to, I think his program also forces the banks to stop paying dividends. Well, Paulson couldn't contemplate doing this. He wanted just his first bailout proposal was simply to create this huge fund under his strict control and to buy the bad assets of the banks, and no ownership by the taxpayer or the stock of the government. No further controls, no regulatory requirements. In other words, pure bailout of himself and his buddies.
You know, I still think they're going to try to do some of that. That was Plan A, and now they have Plan B, supposedly to recapitalize banks. But I guess we're still very, very short on details.
Oh, you're very short, and it's going to be very tough. In fact, all these programs are going to run into serious obstacles, because how do you price the things you're going to buy? And you need some people to evaluate the assets you buy, and if you're going to pump capital in, you have to decide which banks you're going to pump the capital in, and who makes that decision, and what do you do with the other banks? I mean, if they decide they're going to pick out 20 banks to recapitalize, is this throwing the rest of them to the wolves? Is it announcing to the market that these banks are unsalvageable, which could mean that the stock of those banks could plummet, and that would create a new further crisis? I think we're in for some really dramatic developments.
Well, I think we absolutely are, and I believe that this is a plot, Ed. I believe this was planned. Call it a planned panic, but I agree with you that I don't think they ever expected it to get as out of hand as it is. And whatever they may try, I don't think anybody really realizes whether anything they do may in fact succeed. In the article I put out today, I quoted a rather eminent money manager who has been at this for many years. He's 70 years old. He's a guy who really makes some sense and sounds very credible in the commentaries that he writes about market conditions. And he was asked in an interview in Barron's over the weekend, so I assume this was done in the last couple of days. I know it was done in the last couple of days. He mentioned a valuation of the S&P 500 that was only about 10 points above where it closed on Friday. And he was asked where he sees things going from here. And his answer, he really gave a very terrifying answer, that a man who's who is known as the philosopher king of Wall Street, a guy who really studies financial history and understands it, and he said he really does not know what's going on. He hopes that somebody else gets it because he doesn't. And if somebody asks him where this will end up in the end, he simply can't give an answer. And the only answer that he can give is, from his knowledge of markets and history, is in the end, this will be much more protracted, much more painful than anybody realizes. And whatever may be the fair value of the stock market today, I guess the S&P 500 would be the benchmark, markets typically overcorrect by about 20%.
Yeah.
So he sees very grim times ahead.
Yeah. I think one big problem, Steve, has been that they put out these very complex instruments that nobody understands, and this absence of so-called transparency, so that even the market, the people in the market, don't know if they look at a major institution, they don't know how many rotten assets it has, because a lot of those rotten assets were hidden, and they may be divided in tranches, you know, so that one that bank holds or one institution holds some of a block of mortgages and other institutions hold other blocks. How you buy those back and is going to be difficult. But my main point is that this whole thing makes for obscurity so that people don't know. And I have to admit that I've been really surprised at how much rot there is in the banking system, how many bad assets they built up. But the big problem, as this gentleman you're quoting is, I think, implying, is that it was all hidden, and nobody even today. That's why the banks won't lend to one another, because they don't know if they lend to another bank, whether that bank is really a wholesome institution or whether it's going to go down the tubes.
Oh, exactly. And at the same time, they are so strapped by debt. As I understand it, Ed, we don't have a liquidity problem. There's money sloshing all over the place. But we have financial institutions, banks, and other ones that are so hugely over-debted.
Yeah.
That they need everything they can get their hands on just to keep from drowning in the debt they have. And there was stuff out today, and you probably spotted it, that talks about a derivatives time bomb on the order of $650 trillion. And there are other people who put it over a quadrillion. How does anybody understand numbers like that?
Yeah. Well, they don't. That's a big problem. And as you say, this leverage, this is part of the deregulation process. The authorities just stood by while these institutions developed capital to loan ratios of maybe 1 to 30 or more, and then with a lot of hidden further derivatives. So they were putting the financial institutions and the system in a terrifically fragile condition. So, I mean, we get back to deregulation. But the thing I like to stress, Steve, always, is that in fact, it bears on the problem of improving the system now, is that we had deregulation, but even like Clinton, but especially Bush, you put into position of regulators people who don't believe in regulation or believe in gutting it, and some of them are incredibly incompetent, and so that their good underlings quit.
Oh, indeed. They're going to cut us off. Let's take a break, and we'll come right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindeman. I'm on with Edward Herman. Ed, I know we want to jump into some other topics. Maybe just one final comment on this. With everything going on, and despite all of the bold statements from the politicians and so on and so forth, virtually nothing is being done in all of the plans and laws that Congress is passing to help people in most need. People losing their homes, people's savings being wiped out, Bush balking at an economic stimulus plan that will help desperate people. That's another element of this shocking story, where there are so many people so adversely affected, and we'll hear plenty about this in the months and years ahead. But I saw one number recently that possibly as many as 10 million homeowners are at risk of losing their homes. In an article I wrote, I think I used 5 or 6 million. I mean, that's really shocking if it's that much greater than that.
It's amazing, too, to see how the Democrats have gone along with this class warfare system of bailing out the big boys and doing almost nothing for their main constituency. The Democrats are showing a lot of people have said that there's really a one-party system in the United States. It's the property party with two divisions.
And they certainly took us to war, too, Ed. Without the Democrat Party support, we wouldn't be in Iraq. We wouldn't be in Afghanistan. We'd be doing responsible things. I mean, they were right there in lockstep with the Bush administration and the Republicans. And it's so shocking. Shall we go overseas and talk about events there?
Oh, maybe we could talk about the Democrats more. If Obama wins, I mean, he might not win, too. This election process is so rotten, but it raises the question of how much change we're going to get in the system if the Democrats have been so terrible up to this point. And if Obama wins, he's already promised to shift from Iraq to Afghanistan, and he hasn't said a word about cutting back on the military budget. In fact, he wants a larger army. Where are we going to get the money to carry out any social programs? And will he be able to do that, given his indebtedness to the big boys in getting into power? I mean, in the deregulation process, Alan Greenspan was very important, but so was Robert Rubin and Larry Summers during the Clinton administration.
Absolutely.
They fought hard against regulating derivatives. I mean, they're pretty bad guys. They're in the Greenspan class. And if Obama comes in, is he going to go beyond Rubin and Summers? And if he doesn't, are we going to get really pretty very similar overall economic policies? Is he going to be able to move away from the military-industrial complex? It's difficult. Actually, Steve, I have to admit to you, I'm voting for Obama. But I do this partly by the fact that I don't watch his speeches, because I think they would drive me away. I think McCain and Palin are truly dangerous. I think that if they get in, a war with Iran is a sure thing. And the use of nuclear...
Can I cheer you up? I really cheer you up, but I put this in one article that I wrote.
Uh-huh.
Who knows? I mean, these people are gonna do what they're gonna do. Uh-huh. Whoever's gonna win is gonna win, and I think the script is already written. But my sense is that this year is a repeat of 1976. I don't know. I'm only speculating, and I would never predict. But we had the turbulent Nixon years, and Jimmy Carter was picked to be the next president,
yeah.
And Gerald Ford just went along for the ride. And the McCain-Palin ticket is so outrageous, that it almost looks like it's a setup for Obama, because they need a little decompression after 8 years under George Bush. And then the Republicans will take it back 4 years later. And who the devil wants to run the country, given the mess that we have?
You got a slight conspiratorial spirit there. Actually, the business community is what's supporting McCain and Palin. And it's not at all sure that Obama's going to win.
But Wall Street is pretty strong for the Democrats.
It looks strong. But you know about the Bradley effect?
No.
The Bradley effect refers to the fact that Tom Bradley, the California black mayor of L.A., when he ran for governor, the polls showed that he was going to win, but he lost. And there's a whole series of cases where the polls overstate what a black man is going to get. In fact, there's a very good article by a guy, an expert on race relations in the United States named Hacker. He argues, he gives the figure of 7%, that there's a 7% error that you can almost count on. So, in other words, if the polls show that McCain that Obama's winning by less than 7%, he's going to lose.
He's going to lose.
Because
well,
the polls, people don't like. We're off again.
They're going to cut us off any moment. Let's break and we'll come back in.
Okay.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Edward Herman. Ed, I think we both know that the Republicans do not like to give up power, and you could be very right that they will figure out a way, dare I say, steal another election.
What? They could very well steal this election. I mean, there's now a big, even the New York Times had a front page article on the methods of trying to remove voters who are newly registered.
Well, that is very encouraging to hear that.
It's scandalous. I believe that, frankly, I believe that the 2004 election were stolen, literally stolen. I mean, there's some very good books. Mark Crispin Miller has written a good book, and Mitrakis and Wasserman have had several books on the literal theft of these elections by computer manipulation and getting rid of voters. And it's they're working apparently in 19 different states. I saw an article today. In 19 different states, the Republicans are working very hard at contesting new registrations. And they're carrying out all kinds of dirty tricks. I think the right wing manufacturers of the equipment are still in the picture. I really think this election could be swung by the Bradley effect and by literal cheating that's going on on a large scale.
Well, all of the voter roll purges, the machines absolutely can make the election come out any way they want to program them.
Yes.
And,
it's amazing that it's not a front page scandal every day. I mean, here's this crazy country that pretends to be a democracy, and you have they can't even get the election process at all virtual silence about this. I mean, it's just not big talked about. It's amazing.
It's amazing, and it's so disturbing. There's been a lot of good work. I had Mark Crispin Miller on this program some weeks back,
and
he's done some great work on this.
Done first grade work.
Oh yeah, one of his books, Fooled Again.
Yeah.
He was bashed by some of the progressive media for the work that he did, which is to me is the most disturbing of all. If we can't line up on the progressive side together and have a united front, then we've got bigger problems than we thought we had, and that's exactly what happens.
Yeah, I think we'd still be outnumbered rather drastically, I think it's much more important, Steve, that the so-called liberal media have caved in. I mean, if you look at this in the New York Times, which I study closely, the election where McCain and Palin are committing intellectual crimes every day, and this attempt to deregister voters, these things are incredible scandals. But the New York Times had a front page, huge article a couple of days ago on Obama's connection with this guy Bill Ayer, and they try to be balanced. They trash Obama. I think they actually trash Obama more than they do McCain and Palin. I mean, write articles that are seriously critical, so that you have this horrible false balance when in fact Obama is a real gentleman, and McCain and Palin are carrying out a sinister, really sinister, ugly campaign.
Well, I agree.
And
with
on
you.
Substantive issues, they're terrible. I mean, with the collapse of the economy, you know, which occurs in the Bush regime, and two wars going on, the Democrats and Obama ought to be winning by a gigantic landslide.
You would think he would have a 20-point lead, Ed. I mean, it would seem like such a slam dunk in the minds of ordinary people, saying,
yes,
we have to get rid of these people. Look what they did for 8 years. We have to get rid of them.
Yeah. The fact that it's not happening is, of course, it's partly a testimonial to the people who the racist element is still strong. But still, I think the media role here is very large. I think a decent media would have made for an election runaway.
If we had an honest media, there's no question about that, and of course all the rest as well. And you're a student of the media, and you understand this so well. It really is so disgraceful.
Yeah. We should mention that the fact that since the 1988 edition of Manufacturing Consent, the right-wing noise machine has gotten very, very strong. I mean, Murdoch has come into the picture, and the right-wing media and the right-wing echo chamber are now tremendous. And so they made the so-called liberal media very cautious and scary, leaning over backwards to be fair. It's made the media, the liberal media, into lapdogs, and a very good. Did you ever have this guy Eric Boulard on your program?
No, I haven't.
He's good. He has a wonderful book called Lapdogs, which is about the media. Beautiful title, and it shows the media double standard. I mean, his chapter on that Vietnam. That group that trashed Kerry.
Oh, indeed, the Swift Boat people.
Yeah, his chapter on that is absolutely devastating. That in fact, I've always argued that if the Republicans could get away with trashing John Kerry on the basis of his Vietnam War performance, while letting the war evader Bush get away with what he did. I mean, they can do that. I mean, they can do anything.
They can do anything.
In fact, they're doing that now with Obama. This flying up Ayers. You know, this guy Ayers was a weatherman, but he's been a respectable educator for years, and Obama has been connected to him in a foundation that deals with do-gooder, you know, work. But if you look at McCain and his connection to Charles Keating, you know that story?
Oh yeah, the Keating Five.
That is big time.
And
that was
time.
Connected with real policies. Obama had nothing to do with air and terrorism, but McCain had a hell of a lot to do with Charles Keating, who is, I think, still in jail, and his stealing of money from the American people. And he was deeply in that. But that doesn't get as much attention in the New York Times and the press as Obama and Air. And that's a little microcosm of where we're at.
I do believe that the media is on the side of McCain. And at the same time, I'm torn in my own feelings, wondering that things are really so awful after these past nearly 8 years that you would wonder how anybody could line up on the side of a continuation with the same crowd that gave us these past 8 years.
Yeah, it's amazing. It shows the liberal media is not very liberal.
They're not very liberal.
They're part of an establishment that is deeply conservative, and that gets us back to things like all these wars and the military budget. One thing that has been stressed, Steve, in the last week is the fact that in the same time period when the $700 billion bailout was passed by Congress, the same Congress also passed a $650 billion Pentagon budget,
exactly,
almost completely not discussed, and of course not contested by the Democrats. I mean, that tells you something.
That really does tell you something. And the militarization of the country, the so-called permanent war economy, or military Keynesianism, I mean, that cuts to the heart of a lot of our problems, too. We're looting the national treasury to fight two illegal foreign wars, to stay in these countries forever, to pour billions on top of billions.
The very good article by Chris Floyd made this further point, Steve, that the establishment here and even in Europe, too, in Japan, they're finding hundreds of billions or trillions of dollars to bail out the big boys. But they haven't been able, and of course the Pentagon, but they haven't been, they've cut social budgets and constrained them on the ground that they don't have the money. Floyd makes that point very effectively. They sure as hell have plenty of money when it comes to the Pentagon and when it comes to bailing out Goldman Sachs and the rest of them.
Oh,
but
absolutely.
They don't have the money for ordinary citizens.
Yeah, just imagine way back when the idea of privatizing Social Security came up, if that ever went through. Just imagine the damage to millions of seniors now.
Yeah.
To let these sharks get their hands on their money,
whatever
they got from this, this wonderful program for millions of seniors who really would be lost without Social Security.
It
would have been gone.
It would have been a disaster, and the very fact that this gangster regime that's in power could actually bring this up and try to privatize such an incredibly successful system with very low administrative costs. In fact, in a decent and rational society, everybody would realize that Social Security and also Medicare have administrative costs that are minuscule, like 1 to 3%, whereas the insurance companies have administrative costs that run from 20 to 35%. So, and most of those administrative costs are spent trying to weed people out so that they won't get more medical care in the case of Medicare. You think in a sane society, this would overwhelm the political process, and there would be a party that would say, we need single-payer medical care. But no, there's no such party. country.
Oh, we
there is Nader and Cynthia McKinney.
Those are the directions that I lean in. I may not pick a winner by doing it, but I simply can't bring myself to vote for column A or column B, where I really expect not too much difference from either one of them. It really bothers me so much. But if you look at everything that you observe all the time and that I've gotten into myself so much, we really have a political and economic model in this country, Ed, that is so utterly broken. I think the only salvation is we literally need to tear it down to the ground and rebuild something new from the ground up. It's like an old house that is just rotting away, and we've got to take the darn thing down and just put up something completely different in its place, because this thing is so utterly corrupted and broken.
That's a good point, Steve. But one, the big problem is that when things get really bad and the change is in the air and possible, you don't have constructive and good change unless you have an organized base that's well organized, numerous, and that has a good program.
Indeed.
And that's the tragedy of the United States. Is that there is no organized left. There is no organized counter program that has any chance of getting anywhere near power in the next few years. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, all we can do is hope. This is why as I told you, I'm voting for Obama. I'm trying to simply hold the line. I think that McCain Palin would get us into a nuclear war, and they would do really horrible things. Whereas with Obama, I don't expect anything good, very good from him. I think the constraints on him are too huge, but I think I don't think he would be a lunatic. I'm against lunacy.
Well, I'm against lunacy.
We're about to put lunatics in power. This guy McCain is really dangerous. I mean, he's very ill-tempered, volatile, pretty stupid, and he's a warrior. Bomb, bomb, bomb. He wants to engage in with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
He's a real menace. Whereas Obama has a constituency that would like some civil expenditures. He's going to be under a certain amount of constraint from that to not behave like a lunatic. So I'm not asking much. I'm just against lunacy, Steve.
Well, I can't disagree with that, Ed. And I think along with the possibility of a war we don't even want to contemplate, a full-blown police state at home.
Yes.
Because the economic distress could get to the point where it's so great, and there's so much public outrage, you know, about the brigade from Iraq brought back to be on U.S. streets if needed, backed up by U.S. NORTHCOM, the militarizing of U.S. streets on the possibility that there would really be some terrible opposition to what's going on, expressed even violently on the streets by people with every right to be upset about how gravely they've been harmed. And their idea of thwarting it is to crack down militarily against them.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. So we're in a really bad scene. But I'm hoping that what will happen is that we'll can develop enough stability domestically within this rotten capitalist framework, and enough political power moving slightly to the left and bringing to power at least a non-lunatic, that we can sort of get our house in order and prepare for the future and organize for a deeper change. I just don't think we have a hell of a lot of effective choices.
Well, I can't disagree with that. And I never lose hope, Ed, as black as things look. I never lose hope, because you lose hope, you lose everything. Very briefly, they're going to cut us off again for a commercial break. Some weeks back, I had Frances Fox Piven on the program talking about her book, Challenging Authority, where four times in our history, amazing things happen because enough congealed at the grassroots to end slavery, to the civil rights movement, the labor movement. Amazing things can happen sometime at the grassroots. It never gets handed to us. It's got to come from the bottom up.
Right, exactly.
Let's take another break and then we'll finish up the hour that always flies by.
Okay.
Steve Lenman. I'm on with Edward Herman. Oh, Ed, the hour absolutely flies by every time. There's never enough time to get into everything. You mentioned a lot of things that we could talk about, and we need the whole day or the whole week to get into them all.
Yeah.
But anything else crucial that you want to bring up in the last few minutes?
No, I think, of course, I'm very preoccupied with the military. The projection of power by the U.S. I think that the United States is really posing a lot of dangers to the world these days. We are a militarized society. Eisenhower warned about this in his famous address, but he was already too late. We already were a militarized society. The military has such deep roots in America now that it's a true military industrial media complex, and it's self-protective, so it commands resources that nobody else can command. Even in years ago, I remember that scientists, you know, biologists would prepare projects to be approved by the Pentagon, because if they got the Pentagon to support it, they could get it. They tried to get money from the government just on scientific grounds in biology. They would have a tough time. But latch on to the Pentagon, and you would get the money.
Oh, absolutely.
So their command over resources is unbelievable. They now control the expenditures for the military and for past wars is now running apparently at $1 trillion or more a year.
$1 trillion or more a year. Ed, two things quickly. You pointed out to me, and I read it over the weekend, the Monthly Review article by your friend, co-author Bob McChesney, John Bellamy Foster, Hannah Holloman, if I'm pronouncing her name, on the U.S. imperial triangle and military spending. And, of course, the role of the media in all of this. Without the media, it couldn't happen. And one comment about your newest article that I won't mention because it's not published yet, but I like to end sometimes with a hopeful thought. And you at least hint at it as you end your article, and you wonder whether, with all going on today, and it's absolutely horrid, from the economic calamity and the foreign wars, whether something more decent will emerge out of this. And we all can only hope that there's some chance that might happen. If it doesn't, I don't know where we're going. I never thought it would come to this. Neither did you, Ed, many years ago.
I'm surprised at the deterioration, at the growth of military power and the shift to the right wing. But it's all actually been plausible. It's described in this Monthly Review article very nicely, the extent to which an awful lot of the terrible developments are linked to what the military needs, what the military contractors want. They need wars. They need an expansion. And of course, it is absolutely crucial, as you say, that the media support this. They don't question that we have 750 active military bases across the globe. They pretend that this has something to do with our national security, which is a sick joke. It has nothing to do with our national security.
Indeed, Ed. We're out of time. Let me just take the couple of moments that I've got left. to thank you for coming on. You were on with me on my other program mid-year last year, and I value your thoughts on almost any topic at all so much. It really is a great honor for me to have you on. You are one of my great heroes, Ed, so I've got to say that to you.
I hope we'll be on again someday.
Oh, thank you, Ed. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Take care.